Oh, Kronk,
Wagwan, bruv.
how's it going, bro? You good?
Yeah, man, everything cool. Hold on, let me get my. Do you need video or are you?
No, this is fine. Just audio's only. Audio only.
Cool.
How's it going, bro?
Everything's good, man. Everything's blessed. How are you?
I'm good, man. How's your week going so far?
Excellent, excellent. Good start to the week, being productive.
Yeah.
Yeah, super focused. Feeling good, man. Honestly,
Nice.
honestly. How about you?
Yeah, I've been good, man. What's been going on? Bro, it's hot in the UK. It's baking here.
Is it really?
It's baking. And obviously, you're in California, so you're used to the heat. But for us, we're not used to it. So I think it's about, I think currently, like, what would be 25 degrees Celsius?
Oh shit. Yeah,
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
you guys don't really have like AC systems set up and shit like that either.
Exactly that. So when it bakes, it bakes.
Nah, facts. Facts. Be
Yeah,
safe out there, bro.
yeah. PSAs and all sorts.
Real shit.
But yeah, I wanted to speak to you because I met you back in October of last year
Yep.
through a
Yep.
mutual friend Muriel, and I
Yep.
remember us speaking about your career and your journey, and me telling you that you wrote and co-produced and produced so many tracks from my childhood, but also just like hits and classics, right? And
Yeah.
with this podcast, what I'm trying to do is celebrate people who I don't think get the credit they deserve in general, right? So, I mean, so yeah, I thought I wanted to talk to you about your journey, your career, what you've done, what you're doing now. Yeah, so that's why I invited you on.
Yeah, man, thank you first and foremost. And I just want to acknowledge you. You've been from day one, from the moment that we met, just an absolute light, to me. You've been open, you've been collaborative, and every time like you come into the city, it's always love. You always link me up. You always just like, yo, come through, let's chill. You know what I'm saying? And I always really appreciate that and appreciate your energy.
Oh,
And grateful to you for for having me on here today.
I love man. Thank you so much.
Yes, you already know.
Good man. So, where does Kronk's journey begin?
So, I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and that's something I'm extremely proud of. My family, both my parents, I'm first generation Haitian American. Both my parents came from Haiti when they were both 13 and 15. They fell in love in Brooklyn, so I'm a product of a Brooklyn love story. And was born in Kings County Hospital, March 12th. I'm a Pisces, 1974. And it's important that I bring up that year. And the reason I talk about that so much is because I think it's very much in it parallels and is very much in alignment with the trajectory of so many important things that have happened in my life musically, and how those things tend to like align with whom I've become and how I've become who I've become in that process, right? So to give perspective, probably about 6 months before I was born, that was the first, that's where hip hop was created, and that's where it was born. And I,
See.
trajectory of of my life is very much in alignment with that. So, born in Brooklyn, spent the first few years of my life in Brooklyn, Flatbush. My family's still deep in Flatbush, East Flatbush, and Crown Heights as well. What my parents started to recognize pretty early on was that they wanted more for me. They wanted me to see more. They wanted me to be exposed to more. I think they were looking for what was considered a safer life, because as culturally rich as Brooklyn was back then and still continues to be, it tended to have elements that were a little bit dangerous. And so my parents were trying to find ways to keep me engaged and keep me out the street. I think they recognized from very, very early on, I just had a curiosity and a propensity to want to be involved in that, not involved in that life per se, but really more so, you know, to you, I was attracted to it, you know. And so, you know, from there, you know, they decided that they were going to move me to Long Island.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so Long Island is about 35, 40 minutes outside of, you know, the city,
Right.
specifically where I lived. And it's really important to understand what that looks like, because there were some things, again, in a line. I think, you know, I think success, I think experiences, I think these things all happen. They're a series of things, unplanned things that very purposefully create results that now become the seeds for movements. So, you know, my parents decided to move me out to Long Island when I was in the first grade. So I was about 6 or 7 years old. And when I got out there, obviously it was a culture shock for me, because I wasn't accustomed to being in you know, the suburbs, to be very honest with you. I think maybe
Okay.
that's, yeah, like, you know, I wasn't accustomed to grass and backyards and things like that, you know. So they moved me out there, and you know, what I started to find immediately was the diversity. I was very blessed to be moved into what I considered to be a pretty culturally diverse neighborhood. And so the name of that town is called Uniondale. It's next to you know, a couple of better known towns in Long Island, like Hempstead, Roosevelt. So it's kind of I think I would say it's more Eastern Nassau County in New York.
Okay.
So yeah, so I ended up there. Pretty early on, you know, I was a precocious kid. I was a kid who would always find himself in all types of, you know, situations. And I think, you know, my parents did everything they could, you know, as, like I said, young immigrant parents trying to make sure that they were maintaining and keeping their kids safe. I have a younger brother who's 2 years younger than me. And, you know, and that always bled into the classroom. So I had a, you know, when I was younger, I did well in school, because, you know, my father was very much, you know, involved in my education from, you know, early on. And so that gave me the benefit of being, you know, on task and ahead of, you know, in terms of my grades. But what that left was a very, I say, bored child. And yeah, and so when you're in that space, you know, you look for something else. You're trying to connect to something else, you know. And also too, like, you know, there's just a stigma that was always attached, being a child of an immigrant or of immigrants, you know. There becomes like what's the way to say it? A resentment at times to, you know, being different, having, you know, people in your life who, you know, different accents or speak different languages. And, you know, so I always kind of felt like there was almost like an anti-sentiment towards me growing up. And so, you know, I tried to connect with people any way I could. Humor was something that was really important for me. So, you know, I became the class clown, and I was a disruption, just to be really honest with you. So
When you say anti, was that from the other kids? Was that people in the neighborhood?
Yeah, I would say more so from the other kids.
Right.
And, you know, at least that was my experience growing up. And, you know, things you would see things as a kid, you know, that extend beyond your childhood experience, your child experience, right? You'd see how people would treat your parents and things like that. And you know, so I think my emotional intelligence at that point, you know, led me in a way to believe that if I could be funny, if I could make people laugh, or I could do something crazy, you know, that would be a way for me to kind of, you know, assimilate and fit in. And so, you know, especially once you get into a classroom setting where you have a propensity or a high propensity to do well in those classrooms, the resentments tend to kind of come along as well. Kids look at you and then they start with the nerd conversations and being the child of an immigrant. So I had to figure out ways that I could connect with the kids, and humor was that. And when I, you know, when you when I finished my work early, that gave me the perfect opportunity and environment to, be a clown in class, to be a class clown. So I tended to get in trouble a lot very early on, and throughout my whole school experience, my whole academic experience. And but what happened, and what was very significant for me very early on, is when I was in the first grade, I had a teacher whom, probably just for the sake of, allowing me a little bit of both, allowing me to, be curious and find who I was, and in addition, a way to kind of keep me tempered, because, I tended to be a bit much. So during our lunch periods, there used to be a piano in every, classroom when I was growing up. And she would just say, "Well, sit down and, go fiddle with the piano." So we were also learning how to play, these little instruments, these little wind instruments called recorders. And I was able to kind of figure out pretty early, like, oh, well, this is what a scale looks like, and these are these particular notes, and if I use these particular notes, and if I can hear it on the piano, I could play the same thing on the piano. So it started like that for me. And by the time I moved to Long Island and was able to kind of get assimilated there, I started to take saxophone lessons from, I believe, I was 8 on. And again, like, I picked it up really quickly. I developed a propensity for it. And for me, that was an outlet, because I wanted something outside of school. School was the priority in my house. And, I felt like this overwhelming pressure to perform. And there was this weird, interesting dichotomy of feeling the competitiveness to perform, and also feeling this overwhelming rush of, emotions when it comes to, like, belonging. Like, do I belong? Am I, am I different than everyone else? Why is that? Why does everyone treat me differently, even in culturally diverse, and even in a culturally diverse neighborhood? So music was an outlet for me. And, I found myself, connecting with that immediately and joining the band and becoming a part of the band. And that was something that, I followed well into, middle school. And by the time I got to middle school, like, as all kids do, like, their priorities start to change, the way they view things start to change. And, hip hop was very much becoming a part of my life. So, like, the first few years, up until I joined middle school, it wasn't, it was something that I was deeply enamored by and curious by, but my parents, being as strict as they were, they didn't want to allow hip hop in the house. They associated it with, the streets and street activities.
And obviously, they've left Brooklyn to and gone to Long Island to escape certain things, and here you are bringing it into the house.
100%. That's 100%. And, again, having, family members who were, connected in ways that, it just felt, for my parents, I believe their experience was that it was unsafe. So, for me, as any human, once you tell them it's something not to do, it's the first thing that they reach to do. And I was enamored by it. I loved the whole culture of it. I loved the way, people dressed. I loved the way the music sounded. I loved that there was something that was happening that was very much in alignment with who I was as a child. The excitement, the curiosity, the new sounds, everything. It was something that I felt like was very much a part of me. And so, that for me is, that's why my love affair with hip hop is something that continues, and something that you still see to this day. You're seeing still, major artists whom are in my age range, whom are still thriving because of the fact that, we are really, in essence, the culture. So, I got into that, and by the time I got to middle school, I was starting to get in a lot more trouble, and a lot more trouble in the classroom, a lot more trouble in terms of behaviorally. I was wanting to get more connected to things that were happening in the street. This was a very pivotal time, like, from 13, I think, to 17, 18 for me, because, my parents, it was a war zone in my house. I, being young and thinking that, your voice is changing, you're getting older, you think that, you're a man, really not. And, living in a household where that just was not acceptable. So, I was looking again for outlets, looking for ways to, I didn't want to go home, so there were two places for me to go that I felt like I could enjoy, and that's be outside, or, like, be in school where I could be with people whom I knew I could connect with outside. And so, as a result of that, again, music and hip hop and all of that, and the culture of it became more, like, real to me. So, little unknown fact, like, Long Island in the 80s, especially where I lived, was just like a hotbed for talent. And I went to middle school with Busta Rhymes, and also another rapper named Rock Marciano, and as well as a few people who were involved in fashion. In addition to that, like I said, I mentioned two towns, Hempstead and Roosevelt. Those were very important culturally for music, because Public Enemy was from Roosevelt and the Freeport area of Long Island. And they were coming out at times where I was, again, becoming rebellious and really starting to question authority. And I felt like it was very much in alignment with who I was. So, growing up in Long Island, like, where typically, the culture of hip hop was more relegated towards the boroughs, and specifically the Bronx,
Right.
right? But it would, spread out to Harlem, Brooklyn, Queens, right? For me, Long Island was a safe place because, we were all a little bit different, right? You could be connected to the streets, in some way, form, or fashion, whether you were directly involved, or whether you had family members, or whether you went home to you went you know you went back to the boroughs for that, and you could bring, music back, or just you could be comfortable in your difference out there in what was considered to be, like, the suburbs, right? So
Right.
you have a different sense of how you see it, right? Because you don't feel as pressured to be, what it is in, like, the boroughs.
Being able
So,
to do it in a way which is close enough for you to know what's happening, but far away enough for you to be insulated from what's happening.
and yes, in addition to seeing it, what it's like? It's like zooming out a little bit, and almost like kind of blurring your vision. And then now, by blurring your vision, you have a different context of what that art form, or what that or what the what's the word? The how it affects you, in terms of stimulation, right? So, whereas it may have been something really direct in these boroughs, like, and you have, like, all the cultures, you have the b-boy, you have the graffiti, you have, the DJing, right? Now we could take that, and because we lived a little bit further out, maybe, with our exposure to being in other neighborhoods, maybe we didn't wear Lee jeans all the time. Maybe we would wear, Z Cavariccis, or maybe we would wear, Paisley shirts, which would start to kind of move forward into where I really, found myself in the hip hop world in high school. A lot of people don't know this. I don't really tell a lot of people this. Busta Rhymes is the reason for me, and I don't even, and he doesn't know it for sure, that, he did a fashion, not a fashion, he did a talent show when I was in the 7th grade. He performed, got shut down because he was cursing. And I looked and I watched him perform, and a couple of other people that I knew. And I was like, oh my God, I want to do this. I want to be involved in this somehow. And I just couldn't connect the dots with what that meant with being a musician at the time. I viewed music as one thing, being a musician is one thing, and I viewed hip hop as being a completely other thing. And I just didn't understand how to do it. So, I started to lose interest in terms of like my discipline with music in of itself, and wanting to kind of lean more towards whatever needed to be done to be closer to the hip hop culture.
And so, how are you consuming it primarily? Was it through, so beyond the actual physical recordings, were there certain media platforms that were covering it heavily?
Amazing question. We lived and died by our radios,
Right.
right? So we would sit down and listen to the radio stations. We would listen to in New York, it would be Kiss FM, 98.7 Kiss, with big shout out to DJ Red Alert, Chuck Chillout, or it would be Mr. Magic on WBLS. And I would literally sit there on Friday, Saturday nights that I wasn't allowed outside, that I couldn't go outside, and I would sit there for hours and listen to these mixed DJ shows, and literally have a tape cassette on pause to record what the new records were that were coming out at that time. And so because it not only was it the ability to be able to hear things first, it was how we communicated with each other socially once we got back to school. Yo, did you hear the new EPMD record, new Eric B and Rakim record? Like, DJ Red Alert dropped the new whatever record at that particular time. And that was our cooler talk, or our coffee talk, when we went back to school. And so for me, I became completely obsessed with that. And at the same time, I had a family member whom had roots in the music business, and he was somebody that I looked up to tremendously on so many levels, because I was the older brother in my family, and he was 2 years older than me. And so, yes, I felt very connected to him, and so he was like my big brother in a lot of ways. And so whenever I would go to his house, whatever he would put me on to was what I was really like rocking with, and what I was listening to next, and that was my information, my direct information. And I'll go into it a little bit further, who that it was, and how I he was the one who ultimately became my entry into the music business.
Hey, I spoke to someone the other day about this, about the way in which when you know someone who's doing something, it starts being possible, right? That if you're not connected to something, and it's far away from you, it's hard to imagine yourself in a certain space. But when someone you know, or you're in an environment where it's realistic, you then figure out how to find a way into that space. So in your case, it was Busta Rhymes, right? Seeing him do his thing, right? Your passion, right? Your an interest in not being rebellious, but to find an outlet for the way you were feeling. And then having a cousin who was really deep in music. So all these things, interesting, okay.
Absolutely. And not only were they, were they a source of information, they were my source of, they were the things that showed me, they were the people that showed me it could be done. I watched Busta when he was, and other men, guys in my neighborhood, who formed Leaders of the New School. I watched them perform on In Living Color. That for me was like, oh no, I can really do this. That was manifestation at its finest for me. This was like the sign that, oh, I can be involved in this world, and I didn't need to be like a tough guy. I didn't need to do anything connected to what was happening in the streets. I could really just focus my time and my energy in doing this, because that's what I really loved. So, and then being able to witness, like, my family member, as we were starting to get older, starting to really kind of make his way in the music business, that was something for me that it was absolutely pivotal.
So with your family, so you have you who's musical, right? And then your older cousin. Did your parents and uncle and aunts know that you were a musical family? Because in some I found sometimes, right, parents are opposed to their kids doing music, but don't realize that they're musical as well, right? So was there a relative, like a grandparent, grandmother, grandfather, who was really artistic? Where did it come from?
Interesting. Yeah. So let me like clarify this too. So like my cousin, we were cousins through marriage, right? So my uncle married his mother, right? So when I looked at his family, right, everyone in his family were musicians, right? Where and when I mean everyone, from his mother to his, his biological father, and on each side of the family, everybody played a musical instrument. Whereas for me, like that wasn't something that I saw in my family at all. I think that my mom had not aspirations, but she loved music. She was a very important part of the other side of like what I enjoyed about music. And I think that the reason that she was available, she was there for me and supportive of me in the ways that she could, was because, I think that it was something that she would have loved to have been a part of, right? And I think that, that was that was just the little bit of the door cracking open that I needed, right? Where she's like, oh, well, I didn't get to do this. I didn't get, I'm not, as a matter of fact, she told me, she loved the violin. She never really got to play that when she was growing up. So when the opportunity was for me there for me to play an instrument, she encouraged me. And she was also very, integral in my going to school for music as well, and which ultimately probably saved my life.
So you mentioned that, so your cousin is doing quite well in music, and you mentioned that he was the entry point, the your way into the business, right? So how did that happen? What happened there? Was there a conversation? What happened there?
Okay, so being really honest with you, I was at a point in my life where I just wasn't really doing I was doing a lot of maladaptive stuff and behaviors. I graduated high school and I was just out in the street just doing things that weren't really. I was at a point in my life where I was starting to make the switch and really feeling like there had to be more. There was something in me that was like there was something more. I just felt like, there was this hopelessness that was happening with me because, by that time I'd started to discover my voice as a singer and didn't know where and how I could do it. I'd left playing instruments. I was actually removed from the band because of like, behavioral issues. By the time I graduated high school, I just didn't really have any hope. My father wanted me to become a physical therapist, and I went to school for that, and I hated it. And so, my natural instinct was to rebel against that. And it got to the point where things came to a head, and I basically ended up getting kicked out of my house. And when I got kicked out of my house, my mom came looking for me, and when she found me at a friend's house, she was like, what do you really want to do? And I said to her, I was like, I want to do music. And by that time, I had started to, gain a little bit more information, find out what resources were available to me and for me at that time. And so she said, okay, come home and, and that's what we'll do. We'll get you into music school. And so how my cousin played a role is that by this time, he's 2 years older than me. So he's around like 20, 21, 20, yeah, 21, 22. And he'd started to make his rounds as like a remix producer. And, he, my father, I think in an attempt to show support and, kind of extend an olive branch at the time, he actually made the suggestion. He was like, you should reach out to your cousin and see if, you can go by the studio and just kind of see what he's doing. And that was really the start of, what became my road into the music business. So yeah, and to give clarity on that, my cousin, his name is Salam Remy. He's responsible for numerous things, and and was a huge influence in terms of where I landed and how I handled, making records as a record producer, and just as how to carry myself today, in a business like this. So yeah, man, that's how it started. We started, I think my first session was like ninth, maybe some point in 1994.
Okay. And do you recall who you worked with?
Oh, absolutely. The first session that, it wouldn't have mattered as much back then. My very, very first session was for a group called the Fugees. And at that time, they were,
Just the Fugees, only the Fugees.
yeah, no, you know what the funny part was? It's like, now as we talk about it, right? And this is another one of those examples where, like, I watched it happen. And this was the thing for me that was so integral and important in my life, because at that time when I met them, they were, I think, they were on the cusp of losing their deal. And so Salam, actually, that session was a session that I believe saved their career, because that song went on to become Nappy Heads, which was the record that kind of created the buzz, locally in New York, and started to extend beyond New York City. That gave them the opportunity to, get another opportunity to make an album, and that would go on to become, the score.
So, was there a reason their deal was drawing to a close or was about to be taken from them?
Yeah, they had a project that they'd put out at the time, and it just didn't do well. And I think that, that was where I think it was their last shot to, like, kind of figure it out. And that very first session is where, I came out to see Salam, and I remember the studio like it was yesterday, because it ultimately became his studio. It used to be called Soundworks, and it was on 54th Street between 8th and 9th, or Broadway and 8th, I should say. I walked down the steps, and I remember it very vividly. At that time, him, Gary Noble, RIP Gary. So that was really my entry. And it was my first opportunity to really recognize what it looked like to create a record.
Fascinating. So you're in a studio, right, working with the Fugees. And what is the first thing you observe about Salam? Because obviously he's your cousin, but now you're at work, right? So how did familial Salam differ from the Salam who's in the studio?
Actually, none at all. Salam is a leader. He's always a leader. He was the oldest child in his house. He was always driven, always ambitious, always, humble, always quiet, but just, he has that thing, where it's a calming energy. It allows people to be, who they are. And I learned a lot from that, because in my younger years, I operated completely from the ego, whereas with him, even at that young of an age, he didn't operate, or at least it was never presented that way. He didn't operate with an ego. It was always about the record. It was always about the song. So I learned quite a bit, from him, even at that young of an age. And for me, the first lesson that I learned was, watch, observe. You can ask questions, and that's always necessary. But the thing that was more important than anything was to, observe what was happening. And I was already a person who liked to, who was curious and liked to observe. So for me, that was right in my wheelhouse. And it was with those virtues that I was able to really pick up a lot during my time.
And how would you say being a first immigration Haitian, I'm sorry, yeah, first generation Haitian living in the US, right? How would you say that influenced what you and Salam did for the Fugees? Whether it's
Well,
your thing at home that you guys pulled from, that you put into their records.
right. So I think that, because it's interesting, One of the things that were always very important culturally in our family, you know, even though Salam himself, he's not Haitian, right? So, but you know, our family coming over, you know, something, one of the things that was like our running joke for many years, like my mother's Zhanzhan, which is her, like, you know, black mushroom rice, culturally just having that understanding, you know, and Salam just always being so like intelligent and just always soaking up so much. I think that it made it very seamless in terms of just being able to have, you know, crossing that bridge and being able to understand, like, okay, you know, this guy understands us, understands where we come from. And, you know, and even though he may not specifically be that, he was in essence adopted into it. So, I think that that just made it, when you're producing records or when you're writing records and you're in that space, it's really important to make the creative feel, the other alternative, the all other creatives feel, you know, like they could, they feel safe. You know, if you feel safe, you know, now it's easier for you to access the channel that you're utilizing to, you know, put this creativity into the world. So Salam was a master of that. And I think that, you know, yeah, there was a huge part of, you know, all of it is predestined at the same time, right? You know, like here's this group, two out of three of the kids are from Haiti. And you know, here's a young guy himself who grew up in a house where, you know, the culture was, you know, very important, you know. So yeah.
It's funny because one of my first LA sessions was with Salam in 2014. I went there twice that year. I went there in January of 2014 and then again in November. And I went, myself and Elijah Blake went to the studio. And at that time, Salam was managing Jordan Sparks. So I remember going to a studio, and you're right, it was a very calming experience, very chill. There was no craziness. So I see what you're saying, where he does have a very stabilizing and calming energy about himself.
Big time. And like I said, you know, me being a little bit more brash and egotistical, you know, him, you know, always being able to take me to the side and say, like, hey, you know, that you can learn more this way, you know. And don't get me wrong, there were times I didn't listen, and there were times where, you know, honestly, you know, he had to be like, boy, I need space from you because you're a lot, you know what I'm saying? And you know, and I learned more in that as well too, you know, recognizing how to temper and check myself. You know, it's like big brother, little brother energy, to be really honest with you. And you know, just recognizing that, you know, someone who has the ability to, you know, extract wisdom and still, you know, give it in a place from a place of love, and then still also provide it in a way where it's interesting. It's like when you get that, when you have that kind of mentorship, you don't always get it like right there in the moment, right? Sometimes you may hear the words a month from now, 6 months from now, 10 years from now, right? And you know, his energy, it definitely, it provides that. And it's the reason why he's been able to have such, you know, success and wonderful relationships, not just success musically, but success in his relationships in the business as well. It's something that I learned from, and you know, I'm proud to say that I have as well.
100%. But when I met you, we discussed the fact that, if I'm correct, you co-produced Miss Dynamite's It Takes More, right? And Sean Paul's Temperature. So could you give us like a rundown of at least like 10 tracks that you've worked on? Because, bro, you've made some hits.
So this always gets tough for me. All right, so we could start with Miss Dynamite. So Miss Dynamite, just really quickly, I worked on a record called Afraid to Fly. There's actually a version on it's on the It Takes More album. There's another version with Nas somewhere. So that's one. One of my earliest records was a song called Can't Get It Back. Right, and that started with a group called Black, but then it was covered by a legendary group in the UK called Mystique.
Oh, wait, so Can't Get Back was a black song before. Went to Mystique.
Yes. Yes.
Interesting. Okay. Because Salam did work with Mystique as well, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, sorry.
Absolutely.
Go on. Interesting. Wow. Okay, good to know.
So yeah, so we did a record with we did two records actually with them. Another one called Strawberries. And so then Temperature, obviously. Temperature was a record that, you know, was started by another close friend of the of that fam of our family, you know, with Salam. It's Ja Snowcone. And what in essence happened was, you know, that record got started. And they were looking for a way to finish it, and it just landed on my lap, and I had the opportunity to finish it. And you know, I didn't know it was going to be what it was. I was just really, you know, I had a re we had relationships with Sean because, you know, Sean would always come to the studio, you know, in the early 2000s, and come hang out, you know, while we were working on other projects. Whenever he would come in from Jamaica, so. You know, so that was something that, you know, was a great surprise, and that record went number one. Then, you know, I've worked with a Ludacris. I'm trying to count on my fingers. Ludacris. I've worked with Nelly Furtado. I've worked with I've done several records with Nelly Furtado, in Spanish and in English.
Hey.
We've done I did a record with Jamie Foxx.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was on I forget the album now, but it was the same album with Alcohol. Then in addition to that, did some rap stuff, more rap stuff, worked with an artist named Lil Flip. And that was an important time. We've worked with tons of artists. I've worked with like a couple of the Hot Boys. I've worked with BG. Who else? I've worked with Faith Evans. I've worked with one of the ones that I've done more recently that I'm proud of is a young woman named Lauren Spencer Smith, who, you know, she's kind of becoming a pillar in the pop world. You know, and what I'm proud of is like we had like one of the first records with her that really kind of started to pick up steam as she was becoming a star. Man, it's funny. It's like sometimes,
So
like I
many.
see, yeah.
So with Sean Paul's Temperature, right?
Yep.
You mentioned that somebody else started it, and then it came to you. So when they came to you, what did I have in mind? Was there a particular reason that they came to you? Was there something that you were doing that they wanted?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. That's a good question. So, you know, that song, you know, in dance hall culture, you have what you call rhythms, right? So, you know, rhythms could have multiple artists on it, right? And the thing that I think that Atlantic was looking for, and what Craig Coleman was looking for at the time, he was just looking for that final like gloss over the record. And that's really what kind of opened my mind up to the pop world and understanding, oh, well, you know, what pop really is. You know, pop is really genre music with, you know, it feeds off of genre-based music. It is genre music, right? And it's just what ends up happening is there's just this little last bit of glossing over to get it to the point of where it can be ready for mass consumption for me personally. And not that it takes anything away from the culture or the record, because the record in of itself is a true representation of the culture. It was just making sure that it sounded really expensive and that, you know, everything was where it needed to be. Like, you know, the bells and the whistles were in the right places. So I think that's where you know, I provided so much value, is that I was able to, you know, and that's again a testament to Salam's belief in me. You know, he had mentored me to that point to understand the importance of, like, you know, hey, this is the idea and this is the way the record started. Now what are you going to do to take it over the top and finish it? So you know, so I was able to use my skills to complete that successfully, and I played a massive part in terms of even down to the mixing engineer, just being just understanding and having the vision to understand how to take it over the top.
And so, with a song like that, right, can you tell that it's going to be a hit before it comes out? Are there things that you overhear or information that you, because you know, obviously, before any song comes out, you give your information over, like prepare information, And sometimes a label may give you some indication that they're going to spend X amount on radio. Was anything that let you know that you were dealing with a hit before it came out?
Yeah, I don't care what anyone says. There's no way, because I can't tell you how many records that I thought were going to be hit records. I was so sure. And you know, there are so many factors that you know, all of the stars have to align. You know, it's our foolish belief as artists and creatives that simply our art alone is the thing that acts that creates a hit, right? A quote unquote hit. There are so many other factors that come into play. So I didn't know. I had no clue. I just knew the record felt good. You want to know the truth? The only thing I cared about at that time was I wanted to see my name in the credits. That's what I cared about. And you know, the irony was that the day, maybe the day or the week before the record came, I can't remember. I remember sitting with Salam in his backyard and him saying to me, he's like, he got a call. And the call was basically, hey, like the record's gonna hit number one tomorrow. And I just kind of sat there and I was just like, wow, like, huh, interesting. Like feeling really good and just feeling like, oh, okay, made it to the top of a mountain. Now what? You know what I'm saying? So the truth is, no, you know, you have a feeling where you're like, yo, this record feels really good. The record could feel really, really good and could you feel like it has potential. And then it's like, no, that's nothing. You know what I'm saying? Becomes a greatest hits record. You know what I'm saying?
That's when I spoke to a guy called Curtis Richardson, who co-wrote J-Lo's All I Have, and I asked
Yes.
him if he was aware of how big the song was globally, and he said no, right, until recently. So I'm going to ask you, with Temperature, were you aware of how big the track was outside of the US?
So I'm more aware in the past few years how big it is, because like you know, with social media, all my friends who know I've been a part of the record, you know, they'll always like randomly be in some country somewhere, or it'll be some TV show somewhere, and then they'll send me like the screen capture of like the song playing, right? So it'll be some random bar in like Bali or something like that, or somewhere else. And then, you know, and that's what I think what I'm most proud of and what I feel like my bar is with that particular record is that, you know, I want to create records that last as long as that one, you know, that record is now approaching 20 years.
Crazy.
And, you know, and so that for me, I'm like, man, you know, I'd rather have records that I'd rather it not be a number one. I'd rather be a record that, you know, people turn around for, you know, the next 20 years and are like, you know, this is something that's still culturally relevant to me, you know?
Well, now I'm talking about being timeless. If I'm correct, you worked with Amy Winehouse around the same time. She's making Back to Black. Is that correct?
Yeah, so with me, it was more so of a personal relationship as opposed to, you know, really that was Salam's baby, right? From the very beginning, like, you know, from Frank on, you know, that was really because Amy really kind of like she beat to her own drum, to be really honest with you. And, you know, Salam's job at that time was to, you know, make sure he was there to capture that moment. And then like, you know, for the rest of us who were involved, like, you know, we were her safe place, if that makes sense. You know, we were a place that she could be who she was authentically, and she could have her experiences, and that she had, you know, and that she could be who she needed to be, you know, in a world where, you know, she was starting to really enter a world that was, you know, there was a lot of pressure in it, you know, even after she won the Ivor Novello. I think that, you know, everyone had kind of and you know anticipated that this woman was going to become a phenomenon. And I think that, you know, by the time she, you know, was starting to like record Back to Black, I think she was recognizing, okay, there's some pressure here, you know. And She always handled it in my experiences with her beautifully. You know what I'm saying? My experiences with her were always nothing but like the most authentic and genuine and pure. You know what I'm saying? So like I said, I want to make sure that I give that credit due, you know?
What's interesting is, excuse me, how you mentioned that you guys were a support system. And I always think about the ways in which, beyond writing and production, right, how people just being good people, being around an artist, can really influence what they make in the studio, right? So when I look at Amy Winehouse, right, and look at, for example, Lauryn Hill, is there a connection in some way, for example, what her choices that she made artistically inspired by what she has seen Lauryn do?
I mean, and this is, just my opinion. I think that, I believe that, Amy was a master student. She was a master study, and the thing that was always beautiful about her is that she was open about the fact that, she loved the music that she loved so much, and she had such a childlike enthusiasm over like who were considered her heroes. And it didn't matter whether it was Nas or if it was, Patti LaBelle or whoever the circumstances were. And I think so, yes, of course they played massive influences. And, and I think that that is something that, especially having someone or having people in that area who were able to have that familiarity, gave her a sense of like, oh, you see me,
Right. Okay. And so with okay, so okay, interesting. So you do Temperature in 2004, right? And then Back to Black, you're around, and that's what 2000 and sorry, so you, Frank and Back to Black, right?
Yes, Frank and Back to Black
Okay.
between 2004 to 2006.
Wow. And in that time, right, and looking at things now. How did you see the industry change, in and if so, what I'm trying to ask you basically actually is when you compare what you're working on and were around then, okay, and compare it to let's say the last few years, would you say the talent levels have declined in any way? And if so, why?
No, I don't think they've declined. I think it's different. I do think the skill set is different.
Okay.
I think the skill set is different. I think there are people, there's more information. There are more things that young people consume. Maybe the attention spans are a little bit different. Maybe the way they express it is different. If there is a roundness that I miss, and what I mean by that is like, like experience, life experience, these things, as opposed to having excessive access to information, I think if there is a difference, that's what I would say. I think that, with new information, it's scary how quickly the new artist can consume data, right? And also at the same time, I think that there's this space where because artists back, previous in the in 25 years ago moved slower with their process, they had the opportunity to live life in a different way. They consumed life differently. And I think that that was the thing that made the difference in terms of how creatives express themselves today as opposed to, back then, or even 30, 40 years ago.
Makes sense. And it's interesting. And I spoke to Claude Kelly about Britney Spears. He mentioned how, for example, the rise, I think so the paparazzi era was definitely 2000s, but I think it was really extreme, like around like 08, 09, right? Think about Amy Winehouse and Britney Spears around that time, how similar the experiences seem to be from the outside, right? And it's interesting how much of what how much of what happened on the outside world influenced what happened in the studio, as far as you know?
I mean, it's impossible to to deny what kind of influence that had per se, because the reality of the matter is that both women at that time were going through the scrutiny that there is and that there tends to be on artists and creatives, and specifically women, and how they carry themselves is very, it's unfair. And I think that, I think any artist, when you look at artists, it's like looking at athletes, depending on the city that you put them in, depending on the environments that you put them in, can they focus? Can they lock in, and can they, continuously, get the space that they need to channel in a way where they can be creative, and get the product that they're trying to get out. And I think that's extremely difficult to be, to and for anyone to be able to sit still, because sometimes I think that's the reality. Like, as a creative, you have to sit still to get your answers, if that makes sense, So, I just think that it's a situation where, for me, that if you take the Britney Spears, if you take the Lauryn Hills, if you take, Amy's, to be able to have, they need the space to be the creatives that they are naturally.
Okay. And speaking of space, right, and new spaces. You mentioned you're working with an artist now. So her name was Lauren.
Spencer Smith.
Okay, and so besides Lauren, who else are you working with? Are there any artists that you are developing or are creating with that you're really excited about?
So, in terms of artists now, I'm looking. Well, we have Lauren. And then, in addition to that, I just finished working with another artist. His name is Aaron Fraser. We wrote two songs on his project.
Nice.
He just put that out, and it's an amazing project. It's called Into the Blue. And, in terms of anyone else, like, I work with a lot of writers for the most part. I'm working with Romy Dia outside of, she's based in the Netherlands. And yeah, for the most part, I'm kind of trying to keep it slim for the next, year or so, because I just want to take time to see and figure out who, I'm really more concerned, if I'm going to be honest, with making music with people that I enjoy my time with. And so that, for me, is like paramount at all times. It's just like, I want to make pe music with people that I like. So I take my time in terms of like who I create with. I have a couple of collaborators in terms of producers and songwriters that I work with. Oh, I can't have to mention, like, my brother, Lunch Money Lewis, who's extremely important to me. He's another person who's been very much a part of my trajectory in my life. He's kind of like a little brother to me, the same, and which is interesting considering how successful he is. And he's still the same person. He's never switched up. He's someone that, no matter what the circumstances are, we call each other, we talk, we collaborate. There's always, we're always working together. So that's someone who is, for me, a very consistent and co collaborator.
Amazing. So for anyone else who wants to be inspired by you, who wants to reach out to you, where can they find you?
Oh, bro. So I'm glad you said this, because the thing with creativity is, like, this is where I've been shifting more. And I recognize, after all these years, that as a record producer, what I really am is a per is I'm a conduit to helping people realize and actualize them their real selves. And so, sharing my experiences is very important, because I know that there are people out there who feel like they can't be heard or seen. And especially in a world where, even though we have more information, we have less access to how to execute that information. And so I love to share. This, I have way more OG energy than old head energy. There's no hate in me in terms of like how I attribute that. So for me, I try to focus my time and my energy on, really giving in a way where I can, hold on one second.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
That's cool.
Sorry about that. So what I'm focused more so on anything and everything is, how I can disseminate that.
Okay.
So, and what I want to do going forward is, just be able to continue to do that. So for me, if people want to reach out to me and if they want to find me, what I do is I share my stories, I share who I am, and I do that on my social media. I do it on Instagram, Facebook. I'm gonna start a TikTok, but and it's
Nice.
like Krunkadelic. So Krunkadelic,
Nice.
and that's on all platforms.
Fantastic, Kronk. It has been a great conversation. We speak often away from this setting, so it's great to have you on this to kind of share how brilliant you are, man. So thank you very much for coming on.
Bro, thank you for having me. I mean, honestly, I'm so honored that you thought of me to even be involved in this conversation. And man, keep doing what you're doing. I really appreciate you, man. I'm grateful to be on.
Oh, thank you very much, bro. Bro, have a good day.
Thank you, too, bro.
I'll see you.